Welcome to episode 14 of Speaking of Mysteries. This week we spoke to Becky Masterman, whose debut mystery novel, Rage Against the Dying, was nominated for 6 Best First Novel awards, including the Edgar and the Anthony. I think the story of how Rage Against the Dying and its protagonist, 59-year-old retired FBI agent Bridget Quinn, came to see the light of day is pretty interesting. Becky challenged her husband to a novel writing contest one November, which, as everyone knows, is novel writing month. She found out a few things: that her husband could write like the wind, about 4,000 words a day, and once her novel was completed, that, at least according to one agent, no one was interested in a female character over the age of 30. And then, when the world was watching during an Oscar telecast, Jack Black singled out one woman in the audience and yelled, "Helen Mirren, you are hot." And just like that, women over the age of 30 were acceptable in mystery fiction. I should say, acceptable again, because of course, women over the age of 30 have a long history in mystery fiction of being not just acceptable, but popular. But as Becky says of Bridget, "Miss Marple, she ain't." In fact, Becky describes Bridget as Bruce Willis meets Sarah Jessica Parker. But I'll let Becky explain Bridget Quinn to you. Here she is. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. Today we have Becky Masterman, who has written her first mystery, Rage Against the Dying, and has been nominated for everything, practically, and we'll talk about that. Anyway, welcome, Becky.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Nancy.
I wanted to actually, before we talk about all the nominations, some of which you've already attended the ceremonies and some that are upcoming, I wanted to talk a little bit about Bridget Quinn and the fact that you had written 6 novels before that you did sell, and then you wrote about Bridget, and then an agent said, "No one's interested in a woman over 30. And I just wanted to ask how that made you feel.
Well, at the time, the reason I had written that book, which was in that early stage, was called One Tough Broad. It was because I had just gotten married, my husband was retired, and I was wondering what we could do in our marriage. So I challenged him during novel writing month in, I guess it was 2004, November. And so he wrote a science fiction adventure novel, and I thought, well, I'll write a mystery, because I've never written one before. So I just read a bunch of them and saw that, a lot of the protagonists, if they were female, were like these kick-ass blondes in stiletto heels, making wisecracks while they beat up people or whatever. And I thought, well, I want to read about somebody like me. And the fact is that somebody like me has a bit of post-polio syndrome, so I have some trouble walking. And I fantasized about a woman who could meet a mugger and take him down.
And, of course, in the book, when we first meet...
That's exactly what happens.
When we first meet Bridget, she's trying to lure somebody, and she pretends to be frail.
Mm-hmm.
And she pretends that she's, she lets appearances take over. And what this predator sees is a small woman with white hair. And he figures it's going to be easy to do what he wants to do with her. And he's in for a really big surprise.
Yeah, He can't tell that she works out at the gym regularly.
But that's what I mean. I mean, it's the perception that Bridget Quinn is in the book and your description of her. She's 59 years old. She's obviously prematurely gray if she's white-haired.
She's had a heck of a stressful life.
And she's had a heck of a stressful life. And part of it might be, do you think, because now this character's part of you, that it's through her entire life and most of the book,
she carries these secrets that that she feels she can't let out. She feels if she it's like a Pandora's box. If she opens up this box with her secrets, it will ruin everything.
And she had an experience like that where she had actually tried to have a relationship with a man, and when he found out about what she did for a living, these terrible undercover assignments that she had, trying to catch serial killers, he dumps her. And so she decides when she meets the second man, who is an ex-Catholic priest and a philosophy professor, that she's not going to let him know what her life was like.
Now that Carlos does know, at the end of the novel, Carlos does know. Will that be? I don't want to ruin the novel for the people who haven't read it and definitely should. But will this? Will we see Bridget in another novel? And will this now become a change in their relationship?
Yes. The second book, which was just accepted by my publisher, St. Martin's, is called Fear the Darkness, and it will be available this coming January. And I've noticed in some mysteries that the character is stationary throughout, and I would like over the series to see more of an arc of change in Bridget. It'll be very slow, but she will grow into the person she's meant to be.
Will she?
It's just taken a long time for her to grow up.
Will she learn how to cook?
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because in the second book, her niece comes to stay with them for a little while, and her niece is a very good cook.
But that doesn't say that Bridget will take lessons. It's just,
well, she's paying attention, but the niece turns out to be something of a problem. I know we're meant to talk about the first book, but it...
No, we could talk about it. As a matter of fact, I think it's great that we're talking about the next book.
Okay. Well, it's, the way I put it is that Bridget's family always used to joke about Gemma Kate being the bad seed in the family. But when Gemma Kate moves in with them, Bridget finds she's not joking so much anymore.
So you mentioned on your website, when you're in your biography, that you entered this contest with your husband. He kicked your butt by writing 4,000 words a day. And I mean, I think that's a good enough reason to cripple his hands. Just any writer that can turn out more than 1,000 words a day to me is like a god.
I know. That's my goal. And that's, I feel like I deserve to go out to dinner tonight with him because I wrote my 1,000 words.
But
otherwise I would feel guilty.
So you wrote this book and then you didn't sell it for a while. This is what I'm gathering from your site.
Right.
And then you did. You found an agent who appreciated not just the character but the fact that you are a crackerjack writer.
Oh, thanks. And you know, that's the thing. It was kind of the world changing. It was as if that the boomers finally arrived and realized that they weren't their old Aunt Margaret at this age. It was about 4 years later, after I had sent it out to 5 agents, they all rejected it. And then there was that night when they had the Oscars, and some people even remember this moment. Jack Black, a young actor, is on stage. He's in the middle of a number, and he points out at the audience, and he screams, "Helen Mirren, you're hot!" And I watched that, and I felt, I got goosebumps, and I thought, yes, this is our time.
Well, you know, and I bet there are agents, once the book was published, I have a feeling that there were agents that were gnashing their teeth because it has been nominated for just about every award for first novel, including what I think is the top in the United States, which is the Edgar for best first novel. It didn't win, but, you know, as they say, it's an honor just to be nominated. And it was in an incredibly strong field, with Roger Hobbs' Ghost Man, which was a phenomenal book.
It was. I read that one, and you know that the fact is that even saying it's an honor to be nominated might seem ironic. And yet, when you think that there are 100,000 new books that come out every year, the fact that I could get into the top five, it just stunned me, and continues to. I'm so proud whenever I'm nominated for anything, including the Anthony Award.
Right, and the Anthony, that was going to say, you know, another one of the sort of top awards in the genre is the Anthony, for which you're also nominated. And is the feeling that you get having this novel be released and embraced, is it do you feel vindicated? Do you just feel flat out gobsmacked that this is happening? You know what? I mean, it must be such a vindication, because you must have known that this was a good book. You've been involved in writing, and you say you were an acquisitions editor. So you know a good book when you see it.
Well, I was actually an acquisitions editor for Forensic Science Books, so it wasn't fiction that I was looking at and considering. But I certainly read a lot of fiction, and I know, you know, it's like with art, you know, I know what I like. I know what moves my heart, and I have to admit there are certain scenes that I read in Rage Against the Dying, and I still tear up. And my husband did the same thing. The first time he read it, he got to the end, and he was sort of teary-eyed, and he said, "It's a chick book." But he was crying.
Well, I think I can see why someone would say it's a chick book. But she's not the typical chick.
No. And men do like it. I'm very gratified that not only men like it, but young women like it. And I tell them, see what you have to look forward to?
Well, Bridget's in pretty, like you said, Bridget's in pretty good shape, and you know, she's got a handsome husband, and she's hopefully going to redecorate her house, because that doesn't really sound like the kind of space that Bridget would choose to live in.
No, but she sees it as sort of another part of her cover.
Ah, I see.
But at the end, she decides that she is going to make it her own. Well, get rid of the pink satin bedspread.
Right, because it just seems like in the arc of the book, she embraces who, as you said, the character is going to go on this journey. And at the end of Rage Against the Dying, she has come to learn who Bridget Quinn 2.0 is. For
Yeah, where the term reinvention has become popular, and even Bridget can do that.
But at the same time, even throughout her reinvention, I think one of the things I liked, in addition to the story, which was, you know, I love a great serial killer story. That's a personal favorite of mine. Is Bridget's relationship with the younger agent in the office, and using her experiences and what made her leave the FBI to help this young agent negotiate her way through this case, I thought it was really cool, and not something you ordinarily see in a mystery. A mystery, the protagonist is usually an island, maybe has a partner, but this was almost like a protege. You know, she
was doing it again, yeah, just like she did with Jessica, the protege that she lost.
But a little bit different, because in this case, she had the wisdom of a few decades on how to not screw up your career.
Yes, Good way to put it.
And also, in spite of her moral compass, which is very, very strong, there's still an ambiguity in what she does and how she feels. There's truth, and then there's truth, has this truthiness. You know,
yes.
There's...
I like that. I've always been fond of the concept of the unreliable narrator. And that's what Bridget is. She's sort of cagey. Sometimes you can't be sure she's telling you the truth. And sometimes you can't even be sure she's telling herself the truth.
Well, and that's part of, I mean, she's been an FBI agent. She's had to dissimulate, you know, she's had to prevaricate. It's all part of her job. It's part of how, you know, she interrogates. And so when you were doing the research for this book, did you build Bridget out of any one particular person? Had you created her and then brought in skill sets through your research that you were going to attribute to her?
Well, the approach is from a few different ways. One was that I was looking at a J. Jill catalog, the clothing catalog, and they used to have a model in there with shoulder-length salt and pepper hair. And that was part of what formed Bridget. I cut out that picture and put it on my bulletin board. And then I knew an older woman with long white hair who wore it in a ponytail. And I thought, oh, I'll use that. And then I thought of all of the conventional qualities of mystery heroines. And I just took every one of them and tried to turn it on its head. So I think my best way of describing Bridget is Miss Marple, she ain't.
So you're describing her with a negative.
Right. And also, it's kind of a Bruce Willis meets Sarah Jessica Parker.
Only I don't think, does Bridget wear high heels? She doesn't wear high heels.
No.
She wears hiking boots.
Right.
And she has embraced the desert in a very big way. And I just from reading your bio on your site, that seems to be something that you did as well. It's an interesting location. You know, I think that you're in Indian country, and yet this is not a Tony Hillerman-esque mystery. This is, you know.
Right. I think moving here from Florida, which I did shortly before I wrote the book, I brought a perspective and an observation to the area that sometimes people born here don't have. So, like when I was on a panel of with two other women and we were talking about murder mysteries in the desert, they were talking about horses. And I said, you know, my character is actually really keen on moisturizers because nobody ever thinks about how much moisturizer you need to wear in the desert. And I never used it until I moved here. So that's one of Bridget's perceptions of how dry it is and how hot it is.
You need a good moisturizer. And she talks about that too. She talks about the times of the day that she'll go walking and the monsoonal season that Arizona gets about this time of year, actually, in July and August.
Yeah, we've got it. It's rain. Oh, it's been raining. It's so wonderful, Nancy.
That kind of crackling atmosphere, actual physical atmosphere, I think can inform a book and the physical geography of where Bridget lives informs the book. I mean, she talks a lot about the dry creeks and the sides of mountains and going up and how the foliage changes and there's a real physicality in the books, and I wonder, is that going to continue into Fear the Darkness?
It is somewhat in Fear the Darkness. I might back off just a little bit. In Fear the Darkness, we're in March, which is, it's dry, but it's cool, and so there isn't so much so many extremes of weather. But in the third book, I wanted to take a break from this area and from Carlo, too. And Bridget goes to Florida to help Laura Coleman, her new protege, with a case there. So that the climate will change and she'll be more on her own.
So she's going to continue to work with the FBI.
Yes, she finds herself pulled in one way or the other.
Well, you know, as a knowledgeable retiree, is a good thing to have. It's also a nice role model for Bridget's generation. They may have retired, but their skill set and their knowledge is still very, very much part of them.
And I think that there's a new respect these days for that.
Well, what
people know who have gotten older.
I think I certainly hope so.
I don't know if you know about the Richard and Judy Book Club.
No, I don't.
But that's like a national book club. And they every season they choose 7 books. This is in England, and so I was put on their list too of the 7 books.
So you're going across the pond as well.
Well, yes, I'm traveling all over the place, I'm being published in about 10 different languages now.
You have this character that clearly has hit a nerve, and she's not Miss Marple, and she's not Jessica Fletcher of Murder, She Wrote. She's not, sort of a lily white, cozy kind of mystery solver. You know, she has a gun and isn't afraid to use it.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes her a unique character in a world that I agree with you, that's become more accepting of older female heroines, which Bridget is.
And I'm hoping that there'll be somebody who wants to play Bridget.
Oh, I would think there'd be plenty of people lining up. And, of course, you anticipated my next question. I always like to ask this because I live in Los Angeles. Have you received any interest from production world?
Much interest.
Much?
And of course, you know that I can't talk about anything that's in the works.
Right. You could talk about it, but then you'd have to kill me, right?
Right.
Well, you know, it's interesting because actresses like Mary McConnell and who does Major Crimes, and many of these actresses now are finding a home, and many of them are doing procedural mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, and they're popular, and they're well written, and they're really good. And I think that that would be an incentive, and I think that Bridget would make a brilliant character. I mean, she's incredibly complex.
And it would be. I agree that the complexity of the character and the script is so important.
Ah, so you're putting that in the present tense.
Well, if there is a script.
If there is a script. Because you can't say anything. But you know something? I feel good that there has been interest from the production world because she is not a two-dimensional character. She is somebody that you could hear about. She is the type of person that would be asked to speak on The View or The Today Show. She's Bridget Quinn is interesting.
And it's fun the way I do hear people talking about her as if she really exists.
But she does. She does exist. She
and I think she does in all of us.
She may be fictional, but she exists. I mean, you know, you created her, but now she exists, and she's someone who becomes anyone who reads Rage Against the Dying is going to have Bridget inside of them, as you said, and relate to this really fascinating character who's really a tough broad. How much research did you have to do, or did you kind of make it up as you went along?
Because of what I did for a living for 14 years, I had gone to so many forensic science meetings and medical examiner meetings and law enforcement meetings. I talked with people from Scotland Yard and Interpol, and when I have an idea, I can call a number of people and get the details on it, or just pick up their book and turn to the chapter that I need. So it's a lot of research that's been going on for years. And when I said these are the kids. The qualities that I applied to Bridget that I saw in real life. Well, I have an author who was part of the National Geographic program called the Mummy Road Show, and he would travel all over the world and look at mummies that people had and analyze them. So when I was looking for some sort of a perversion for this one character to have, I naturally thought, oh, mummies. And I contacted my author, Anil Agrawal, who is in Mumbai, and asked him, I said, you have in this book that you wrote for me, you have 547 paraphilias, which are things that arouse people. And I said, I looked down, and I can't find anything about arousal by mummies. And he said, oh, my goodness, I haven't thought of that one. He said, I'll have to get back to you. So he wrote to me again a few days later, and he said, I have now named a paraphilia in your honor, mummiophilia. So this is the way my research goes, and it's wonderful.
I think that's sort of a wonderful story to have a perversion named after you. How many writers can say that?
And I deal with other tough guys. This one guy who wrote the Bible on homicide investigation, he always said if I didn't give him the terms of his contract that he wanted, he'd kill me and put my picture in his next book. You get kind of tough working with people like this.
Let me ask you a question. Were you sitting across the desk, or was it over the phone?
It was over the phone. Vernon knows I'm not afraid of him.
Who says writers aren't cutthroat?
Which sounds like a good theme for another book.
Well, listen, Becky, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for telling us the story of Bridget Quinn's backstory, and we look forward to meeting some of her family, which does sound interesting, both from your conversation and her allusions in the book, and that we'll get a chance to see Carlos, and I'm glad there's going to be a number three. And even though you can't say anything about it, I'm hoping that we'll see Bridget on either the big or small screen.
Oh, me too.
And good luck with your awards as they come up, and you very much deserve to win. Thank you again for your time.
It's been such a pleasure, Nancy. Thank you.
After we finished the interview, Becky and I chatted a bit more about what makes mystery fiction so popular and how, as Robert Craze once explained to me, fiction is an incomplete art. That is, it isn't finished until the reader experiences it. Becky explained the reader's manifesto to me. She sent me a copy, and I've posted it on the website. Which reminds me, please check out the writers we have scheduled and let us know if you have any questions. Feel free to leave comments on the website, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Next week, our interview is with Mike Lawson, creator of the Joe DeMarco series of thrillers. Until next week, thank you very much. This is Nancy Clare at Speaking of Mysteries.